your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy, Ryan Lambert. RL, what's going on, man?
What's up?
It's been a while since we did one of these. And I know. And we're going to do a mailbag, and it's been a while since I've done one of those as well, so I figured it would be good to just combine the two. And we're going to take some listener questions here, see how far we get, have some fun with it. If you want to get involved in future editions of this, invite link is in the show notes of the Discord, easiest way to pop in questions, so get in there. And I guarantee you'll find yourself spending more and more time chatting with people who listen to the show and just want to nerd out about hockey. So it's a really good spot. And with that out of the way, let's dive into the questions and see how many we can get through. Let's start with this one. Carmen asks, what should the Ducks be looking to do this summer? I feel like they've been penciled in as a team ready to take a leap with their talent, but you look at the on-ice product they put out there, and it's still incredibly poor. I'm very skeptical it's possible for them to do enough where they have even an okay chance at competing for a wild card next year. So the Ducks, as we recall, it seems like almost another lifetime ago now, but started the year winning a bunch of close, come-from-behind games, were being led by Pavel Minchikov, Mason McTavish, really fun performances. Everyone was like, all right, maybe this is the year the Ducks finally start to show some of that potential. You look now, they're 30th in the league in point percentage, 30th in goal differential. Depending on how they finish these final 13 games, they have a chance to match last year's results in terms of points and goal differential, where they were 32nd in both and it was a miserable season. And yet it feels like the vibes are slightly different because we're seeing Minchikov and Leo Carlson and some of these guys still produce, but the results haven't reflected it yet. So in your opinion, what should the Ducks be doing here in terms of both the short and the medium term view, and kind of how do you take this next step from being like this team that's accumulating a bunch of young talent to actually finally starting to win some games?
Yeah, I think the big issue for them is that they have been doing kind of the thing that I hate from teams that aren't particularly competitive, which is, well, you know what? Let's try to accelerate this rebuild. Let's go out and sign a bunch of veterans who aren't very good to big money contracts and hope that gets us to at least pretending we can compete for the playoffs. I think, you know, that's a kind of a loser mentality. And they need to not do that this summer. That would be my big suggestion to them, is maybe try to work a trade. I mean, you know, you got all these young pieces that you're supposed to be excited about. Try to work a trade for like a younger, better roster player to accelerate the rebuild if you want to do that. But yeah, just don't give like whatever. I don't want to like pick on Radko Gudas, I guess. Like, he's been fine for them. But don't give like $4 million to a Radko Gudas type who's in his mid-30s.
Yeah. I actually think Gudas has been good, particularly with the right shot defense element. Like, I'm pretty sure they could turn around and get, assuming they wanted to, get a nice little return for him. The Alex Kalorn one is obviously a more difficult one to justify, especially because of the term.
Right.
I'm with you in the sense that, like, I'd like to see them kind of consolidate and actually get meaningful pieces as opposed to just sort of doing the same thing over and over again. At the same time, though, you look and they have like $49 million in commitments next year, which leaves them with in the high 30s in cap space. And that's going to be the case for, I think, at least two more years once you finally start getting into that 26, 27 range, when guys like Minchikov and Carlson and Zellweger and even Zegras, if he's still there, are up for new deals. Then all of a sudden those guys are going to become more expensive. So you essentially have two more years here now to just spend as much money as you want. It'd be nice to see them do that in a constructive way where you leverage that into bringing in players who can legitimately help right now beyond just being veteran leaders off the ice and all that stuff, right? So I'm not sure that probably won't come in the UFA market, especially when you look at this year's class. I'm with you. The trade market in terms of like moving some of this stuff to get a player who's in their prime right now that can be legitimately good, those obviously generally aren't very available, but we do see guys come up every once in a while, and especially with the types of futures the Ducks have in terms of prospects and picks, I'm pretty sure they could swing whatever deal they wanted to, assuming they were interested in doing so. So I'm with you on that.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, they're kind of a, you know, I mentioned I guess I alluded to the Senators and the Red Wings earlier, right? And the Ducks are in a very similar situation to those two teams in that they can try to accelerate the rebuild all they want. How do you break into that top three or even top four in that division? That's a very, it's a tough task. You know, like you can just pencil in Vancouver, Edmonton, and Vegas next year as the top three in some order. And then you're like, okay, well, now we got to add to compete for a playoff spot that we're certainly not guaranteed to get. So it's really difficult for a lot of these teams that are trying to stop rebuilding. I don't see what the path forward is for them, really.
Yeah, the easiest thing to do in the NHL, assuming you have full buy-in and sort of the green light from your ownership group, is to just tear everything down, right? Because essentially you just trade everyone away.
Yeah, of course.
You suck for a couple of years, you get a bunch of high picks, and you become the franchise that everyone is excited about because you've got all these guys who are top people's draft boards at the time. The tougher part is sort of taking that next step in terms of actually becoming good and executing the right moves to do so. Now, I think we'd agree like progression isn't necessarily linear, right? Like you don't go from being this bad to all of a sudden like pretty good to a playoff team to a Stanley Cup contender. I think sometimes, especially with these young players coming into their own, it can be very rapid acceleration if that happens. And I do think they have the foundational pieces, right? Like what you're seeing from Leo Carlson this season, despite the injuries and the load management at the start of the year, when he's been on the ice, he's like a 51% shot and expected goal share player at 5-on-5 on a miserably bad team. And for a 19-year-old yep. center to be doing that, that's a foundational piece. What we've seen from Pavel Minchikov in terms of the way he plays, that's foundational to me. And those are the toughest pieces to get. Now it's a matter of surrounding yep. them with good players so that they're not on their own and that you're winning the other minutes as well. So a lot of work out ahead of them, but I still think the runway is pretty clear because of the flexibility to take some like big cuts here. It's just a matter of what they are and if they prove to be a difference maker, right? Rather than going out and spending a bunch on Alex Killorn. So we'll see, but I can't quit the Ducks, Ryan. I'm still so intrigued because I love so many of these young players.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, they're going to add Cutter Gauthier in a couple of weeks, right? Like that's one of the best college hockey players in terms of pure goal scoring that I've seen in a really long time. So guy that can actually just like, oh no, I'm going to teleport the puck into the net now. Have a good one. Like, I don't know how many guys there are out there like that, you know?
Yeah, that and another top five pick and like a bunch of first, seconds, and thirds this year yep. as well. So very intriguing stuff. Okay. Here's a question that I think is interesting to consider. So Kobe asks, seems like more and more people are picking up on the fact that Cale Makar is not having a year up to his standards despite his point totals. Yet for some reason, he's still talked about in the Norris conversation as being part of a two-horse race with Quinn Hughes for the title. It'll be interesting to hear you guys talk about his season and what's going on with him right now. It still feels like it's a year where he's going to be a Norris finalist because of points, reputation, and general laziness amongst voters, just like when Victor Hedman finished third in 2021, despite being injured and hurt and bad all season. Guys like Dobson, Josi, Forsling, Heiskanen, and McAvoy all seem like much better candidates this year. So where are we at with Cale Makar? Because obviously, like, he's on pace right now for 22 goals and 96 points over an 82-game season. That sounds amazing. The overall numbers, when you look at them on the surface, look fine. When you dig a bit deeper, especially in his minutes without McKinnon, they're not quite as good. Just anecdotally, it seems like watching him, there's been fewer sort of like splashy highlight reel plays than we're accustomed to in years past, where he's still productive, but not necessarily in such a mesmerizing way. I think you could attribute that to health and being banged up. And I know he missed a bit of time. And so I think that mm-hmm. makes sense. Is it as simple as that or kind of where are you at with this, especially in the, like, we're talking about nitpicking here amongst the best players of the position, right? I think for 99% right. of NHL defenders, they would love to be having this season. But when you're talking about second or third or whatever in Norris Trophy voting, that's where you do have to sort of look at this stuff with a magnifying glass a little bit.
Yeah, it's just really tough to say because, like you said, this is still one of the elite defenders in the league. And for him to just be like, we're going, oh, I can't believe how not great he's been this year. It's like, yeah, he's still only like a top 20 defender in the league, maybe even top 15, you know, depending on, I guess, how you'd look at things. But I just think a lot of it is that things have been slipping defensively a little bit for him this year in particular. And I don't know what I attribute that to. Like, you watch him and you're like, yeah, he's still Cale Makar out there. But all the this is where like the eye test and the underlyings diverge, right? Where you're like, yeah, but he just doesn't have that same zip, even though he looks like he does most nights, I feel like. So I guess, like, just, you know, like I said, looking at the stats, you go, well, the defense is the problem. And according to, you know, Evolving Hockey's WAR stats, it looks like it's shorthanded is particularly a problem for him. But I guess I'm not, like, enough of a systems guy to know, like, and of course, if you look at what they do X, Y, and Z on the PK, that's the real issue here. I have no idea.
Yeah, what's interesting is that, so at 5-on-5, and I think the listeners sort of pointed this out, with him on the ice out there, all like 5-on-5, all the total sample, 53% shot share, 54% high danger chances, 53% expected goals, 53% actual goals. All that's well and good. He's played 70% of those minutes with Nathan MacKinnon. In the other 30%, those shares drop down to 47, 45, 47, and 40% goal share. Now,
yeah,
I think this is where we get into the conversation of, like, usage and context and how important that is, and how we probably too recklessly brush that to the side and be like, oh, well, if you're a good player, you should still be winning these minutes regardless. When the Avs right now, by design, and this is a good thing, this is what the team should be doing, are giving Nathan MacKinnon all of the offensive zone minutes. Like, he's got, yeah, I think, more 100 or more offensive zone draws at 5-on-5 this year than any other forward in the league. Like, if they're out there in the offensive zone, they're like,
hell yeah,
go out there. You're really good. Mikko Rantanen's really good too. You guys should try to score. And they're doing that. And so that's all well and good. The issue is, though, when he's not out there with them, previously it was with, like, Ryan Johansson, and we've talked about how big of a black hole he was. Otherwise, it's defensive zone assignments with that Ross Colton and Miles Wood line. And so it makes sense that the numbers would drop off and wouldn't quite look the same, right? So I think that's a big thing. And when you combine that with health or however banged up he's been, it makes a lot of sense. But more recently, he had that hat trick against the Red Wings, I believe. He's, the past 10 games or so, the numbers all look like they're bouncing back. So I think part of this is, like, a team thing in terms of the way they were using him when he's not out there with the top line. And part of that is just him getting right physically himself. And so I'm not at all worried about him moving forward. No, but yeah, no. I think when you get into, like, there's been some really good defensive seasons this season beyond Quinn Hughes, even though it does feel like the Norris is wide open a little bit. But I also did want to push back on the idea that it's a two-horse race, because while the market has Makar at second right now in betting odds, Quinn Hughes is minus 600 favorite, which is like an 85% implied probability. So I guess I'm pushing back on the notion that it's a two-horse race, because it's basically Quinn Hughes versus the field, and everyone is taking Quinn Hughes there. So where it gets interesting is when you go, like, at Cale Makar or some of the other names you mentioned. But yeah, I think it's fair to nitpick in that regard. At the same time, though, I still think he's an absolute monster, and in the playoffs, he's going to do some really cool stuff.
Yeah, the Avs depth is kind of the big issue. And like you say, in the playoffs, he should do some cool stuff. But at the same time, the playoffs is where, like, depth gets exposed a little bit. And it's crazy. I just pulled up their, like, just their team scoring page. And it's, you know, MacKinnon, Rantanen, Makar, 1, 2, 3. And all those guys are north of 75 points. Nichushkin's at 49. And then nobody else. They have two other guys who are even at 40, right? So, like, the drop-off is so severe. And, you know, like, Drouin and these guys, like, oh yeah, if Cale Makar is going to, like, prop up those guys, or the Colton line, like you said, like, if you're like, oh yeah, we need you to go out there and make Miles Wood look good, well, it's going to be a tough draw even for Cale Makar.
It will be, certainly. Yeah. I guess the reason why I do find this interesting, though, is, and I think you hit it on the head there in terms of, like, the stuff off the puck and maybe defensive issues within the team context, because you look at Corey Schneider's tracking of, like, all the micro stats with him with the puck and stuff, he's still in like the 100th percentile,
right,
at the defense position in like every single thing involving moving the puck or setting others up or carrying it and stuff like that. Yet the results themselves are dropping off a little bit. And I think that's where you get into like what he's doing visibly when he has the puck versus the team concept of what's happening in other situations. So I think that's notable. And I just wanted to shout out because the names were listed here. And one of the names that did pop up was Gus Forsling. And on a show recently, I said a real testament to whether you're a puck knower or not is if you have a vote and you wind up giving Gus Forsling a Norris finalist bid this season. And I stand by that. The more I think about it, the more I watch him play, the more I look at his numbers. Like, they've given up 26 even strength goals with him on the ice this season in 1200 minutes. It's absolutely obscene what he's doing. I think Dom has him as a top 20 guy in terms of toughest defensive assignments this year. And they're just absolutely dominating with him on the ice. And I think that's going to be an interesting one where we've come so far with voters actually valuing this stuff at the same time. I think he's not even top 30 in defense scoring this season. And so,
right,
I'm sure there's voters out there that still think that like Aaron Ekblad and Brandon Montour are their top two defensemen without realizing that it's actually Gus Forsling, because they're not paying attention to this stuff. And so he probably won't get the love he deserves, but man, Forsling is right there with all these guys.
Yeah. And I mean, Ekblad and Montour also miss so much time, right? That like, I think the reason that people think that is going into the season, you would have said, yeah, Montour and Ekblad, sure. But of course they missed a bunch of time and at the beginning of the year, and Forsling was like, okay, you're the number one guy kind of by default. And he was like, no problem, boss. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to do unbelievably well. And so what happened is over the course of the season, they've just been like, yeah, I can't really justify taking him off the tough assignments and the top pairing and all that. So that's why that's happening. Like, Montour actually averages more ice time per game when he's in the lineup, but you know, he also missed 15 games or whatever. Mm-hmm. So like that's why Forsling deserves to get that kind of love. I was going to say he's going to get that kind of love. I don't, like you say, I don't know if he will. He should.
But yeah.
Yeah. He's just been so good this year.
But guys like that typically, you know, fly under the radar because he does it in a much more subtle way. Like even with Montour, like when he's at his best, it's so visibly perceptible, right? Like,
yeah,
he's flying around. He's like throwing the body. He's shooting a ton. Like, he's just so, his fingerprints are all over everything. Whereas Forsling is much more like behind the shadows, like just making sure everything is in the right position and setting everyone up for success. And that's a much mm-hmm. tougher thing to quantify unless you actually take a bigger picture view of it. All right.
Yep.
Let's do one more question here before the break. Andrew says, I love hockey, but baseball feels like it's 5 to 10 years ahead of it analytically. In baseball, when teams or players consistently underperform or overperform their expected models, analysts attempt to tweak the models to capture that. Is it possible that a team like the Rangers simply doesn't fit current hockey models in some way, as opposed to just getting lucky over and over again or having great goaltending? Now, I think this is an interesting one. I think this would have applied much more in previous seasons to this Rangers team. And we're going to get into that here because I think this year, although there's a lot of metrics, depending on what you look at, that suggest that they're a very good team. They're 3 points behind Boston with a game in hand for the President's Trophy. So obviously they're having a remarkable season. But I think this is an interesting conversation for us because there certainly are kind of outlier teams like this. And we've highlighted the Rangers as one in the past that continue to find success despite traditional underlying metrics, especially shot shares and expected goal shares. So what do you think about this and Andrew's question about it?
So, I mean, like you said, like year after year, it feels like they're getting lucky. And you know, if you just look at the numbers, and obviously they have a great goalie. I don't know that I think they're getting lucky. I think that they score a ton on the power play, you know, again, over the last like 3 or 4 years. And at some point you just have to go, well, that's a repeatable skill for them. You look at the talent level on their top power play unit and you just have to think, okay, those guys are just going to score a bunch of goals on the man advantage. It's that simple. And when you combine that with the fact that again, like they have elite players at 5-on-5 as well. Their problem has always been depth issues, right? Like when those top guys are off the ice, they get killed. And I think that's, you know, with I haven't really broken it down in a while to like really dig into their underlying numbers. I just kind of take for granted at this point. The depth isn't going to be very good. The top guys are going to do all the stuff that they always do. And the goaltending for the most part is going to be there. Obviously, Shesterkin's been a lot more up and down this year. And Jonathan Quick, you want to talk about getting lucky. Jonathan Quick being like 940 for a couple of weeks here and there has been what kept them in that like top of the East race. That's where I'm at with the Rangers.
What's interesting with them is natural, like if you just look at natural statric stats, they certainly don't like they paint them in a getting lucky light this season. They're 16th in 5-on-5 shot share, 22nd in high danger chance share, 24th in expected goal share behind a team like the Coyotes. And you're looking at that and then you point out that they're 3 points out of the President's Trophy race, and you're like, how is that possible? Even though that's just 5-on-5, and you mentioned the power play success. Sportlogic has them 8th offensively in expected goals, 10th defensively in expected goals against, and both those are kind of in line with the actual goals being scored. And then they're 6th on the power play and 5th on the penalty kill. And so I think what they're doing is very clear this year. If anything, they've become more aggressive under Peter Laviolette in becoming like a rush team and trying to attack that way than they did previously. But still a lot of like high danger passing leading to these chances. And you mentioned the depth. I think an interesting trend I'm watching is, while I wasn't necessarily that high on Alex Wenberg individually as a player in Seattle, dropping him into the situation where him and Kaapo Kakko are just playing on this third line that's like gets to just dominate territorially, and the Rangers will be totally fine if there's not many goals scored, is a situation for them to succeed. And they've been doing so far in that way. And so as long as the bottom six can essentially just play to a draw and then allow Artemi Panarin's line to come out and dominate, and now Zibanejad's playing a lot better with Jack Roslovich there, all of a sudden now I think you're cooking with some interesting materials as opposed to previously when it was kind of hanging on by a thread at 5-on-5. So yeah, I guess I'm pushing back on the notion that they're getting lucky. I think previously we might have had some issues with it. Now I just think they're a legitimately good team. Like they're right there in that top tier of teams, and that's what the standings reflect. So it's interesting how they've, I guess, taken a step in that regard this season compared to years past.
Yeah. Just to kind of say, like to compare them to another team, that it's kind of like the Oilers a few years ago, where it's like, were they getting lucky because, you know, McDavid and Dreisaitl were going so like far beyond psycho. And then when those guys were off the ice, you know, the Oilers scored 38% of the goals or whatever. And it was the Rangers used to be a lot more in that same vein, where it's like, all like you said, all they got to do is hold the line at 5-on-5 when the big guns are off the ice. And then the big guns come out and, you know, score 58% of the goals and it's fine, you know? Now they're, like you said, at the deadline, adding these guys that just help them kind of smooth that out is so important for them. And you know, now we don't have to pretend like the kid line, which I hate to say, is like they're 3 weeks away from really turning it all around for the Rangers. It feels like they don't have to do that anymore.
We have hit a different, like a crossroads here, though, where I think your level of perspective on this stuff is very telling in terms of like analysis. So if you're just purely looking at stuff through, all right, well, this was the shot counter and this is where the shots came from on the ice, and that's going to tell us who the better team was. Like, that's obviously not what's happening in hockey right now. And so I think that's where this is interesting, where individual talent level is very real. The types of shots you're consistently generating is a real skill. And there are obviously going to be both individuals and teams that have those individuals on them that are going to find ways to be in the blind spots, a lot of this stuff, until we get more information that can be siphoned into the models. Right. And so the Rangers were that for a while. And there's certainly teams on both extremes that are going to fit that bill. So very interesting stuff. Okay. Let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll jump right back into the mailbag questions and keep doing them with Ryan Lambert. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here on the Hockey PDOcast doing a mailbag with Ryan Lambert. RL, why I got you here? We got to do your NCAA corner. Every time we got you on, we get some NCAA questions. As someone who covers it closely and is equipped to talk about it, I got to pick your mind. So here's a question for you, and it comes from John. Okay. As someone who doesn't watch a ton of college hockey, can you talk about what Macklin Celebrini's ceiling is? Now, I think this is really fascinating because clearly he's going to go number one and that's been established. But when you, I think the quality of this draft has sort of been framed as being substandard compared to previous ones and like your general ideal of what a draft looks like. I think the misconception with that is, I think that speaks more to that range once you get into the teens and in particularly to the 20s and where it becomes a bit more of an unknown as opposed to maybe previous years. I don't think that's a reflection on the top of the class because Celebrini, by all accounts, is a truly elite player. But in projecting ahead as like the crown jewel of this draft, where are you at right now in terms of whether he's in that truly potentially generational franchise altering player or whether he's just a really, really, really good player that anyone would obviously be happy to have, but doesn't necessarily mean that getting him is going to entirely change the trajectory of your organization.
Yeah, I don't think he's a generational talent. I reserve that for your Bedards and McDavids and Crosbys and things like that. But yesterday he was named to the top 10 for the Hobey Baker Award. I fully expect him to make the final three and probably, quite frankly, win it, although that is a little bit dependent on what he does in the next few weeks, obviously. With that having been said, he's doing that at the age of 17 years old, right? Like, he doesn't turn 18 until June, and he is playing against guys who are 22, 23, 24, 25 years old. For example, you mentioned Cutter Gauthier earlier, I guess. You didn't bring him up. And Cutter Gauthier is like a year and a half older than Celebrini is. I think maybe even more than that now that I say it. And the fact that they're even vaguely competitive in terms of like Celebrini's, you know, just as impressive, quite frankly, on the ice. And then you take into account the age and you're like, oh, that's a huge thing. Like, I can't remember the last time I saw a player, if it ever happened, play his entire freshman college season at 17 years old. I was there. So anyway, when they announced the Hobie top 10 yesterday, Cam Robinson from Elite Prospects pointed out he's the first 17-year-old to ever be nominated for the award. And in a conversation with our buddy Tom Drantz, Robinson said he's easily the second best prospect in the last 5 years. So I think that is something for people to keep in mind. Like, yeah, okay, the totality of the first round or whatever is not great, but the tippy top of it is, you know, like he said, he's the second best prospect since 2020, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't know what more you can say about it, you know?
Yeah. 30 goals in 33 NCAA games a season. Pretty good. And I think that's certainly going to play
as a 17-year-old
right away. Yeah. Not bad. What do you,
and the other thing is if I can quickly point out, I would say that he did not, they've really experimented around him with his line mates too. Like Cutter Gauthier has basically had the same line mates all year. There were some injuries to guys like Gabe Perreault who has been really good for BC this year that mixed things up a little bit, but for the most part, Gauthier's line mates have been pretty static, and certainly the power play unit, he's the top power play unit, has been, whereas they've kind of really had to mix things up to keep BU dangerous just because they don't have nearly as much forward depth as BC does.
Yeah, my question for you as a follow-up to that then is, I guess it'll be dependent, or maybe not, on which team he wound up going to at number one. But has he done enough already this season? I mean, typically we see first overall picks, regardless, just immediately start playing for their pro team. I guess an example of that not being the case would be someone like Owen Power recently, where he went back for the extra year. But if he went to like San Jose, for example, that situation is so bleak. Do you think there's a possibility where he would go back for another NCAA season and then come at the end of the year, burn the first year of the ELC and go that route? Or do you think the fact that like he's already at a goal per game this year as a 17-year-old, it's like, all right, I've already kind of shown that I'm not necessarily outgrown this league, but there's not that much more for me to improve on here. And he's just going to want to immediately step into the NHL from day one, regardless of the situation, kind of like Bedard did with the Blackhawks this past year.
So it's a little, it's interesting because he's so young, right? Like if he were 6 months older, I would say like, no, it's a no question slam dunk. As you might imagine, this has been a topic of conversation in a lot of press boxes at college hockey games in recent weeks. Basically my understanding of like everybody taking the temperature of this, including myself, is it is very team dependent. You mentioned the Sharks, obviously they're, like you say, it's bleak, but what you got to keep in mind is the GM of the Sharks, Mike Greer, played for Boston University. The coach of the Sharks, David Quinn, played for Boston University. They might have a bit more of a vested interest in saying, you know what, why don't you stay an extra year in college versus, you know, they're kind of like, what would you say, like 2 years behind Chicago in the rebuild cycle?
Yeah, I'd say at least, right? Because they're still in the tearing down process. Like Chicago's fully torn everything down. They're still sort of. I mean, they just traded Hurdle, but there's still Couture and Vlasic there. Like there's still, and so much retained dead money on the books that I think there's still multiple years out from even considering being like, all right, let's start putting together a competitive team.
Yeah, and so that factors into it obviously more than whose alma mater is what, right? Whereas Chicago, if they get the top pick, or let's say Anaheim, or you know, take your pick, they're further along in their development. Where a you know it's easier to slot Macklin Celebrini in behind a Connor Bedard or a Leo Carlson than it is whoever you want to say is going to be the top guy in San Jose next year. You know, but I think my issue with that is the risk for anybody signing him is that if they feel like he can't cut it at the NHL level as, you know, a guy who's playing his entire season at 18, now you're in a situation where you have to send him to the WHL. And you want to talk about it, if he's too good for the for college hockey, he's way too good for the WHL. Like, he's scoring a goal a game against, again, 23, 24-year-olds, you know? If he's only playing guys who are, like, 17, 18, 19, 20, he's going to destroy that league. So I don't... And then you get into the Shane Wright thing, where it's like, do we just kind of keep him around and then, like, send him down, like, halfway through the year? I don't know that that's good for anybody, you know? So I wouldn't be surprised at all if he comes back for another season of college hockey, especially because BU will be adding Cole Iserman to the mix. And if you can go, you know, I think the view on Iserman as the number two pick is really dimmed this year. But if you can go two top five picks, let's say, down the middle for BU next year, especially considering they're probably going to lose Lane Hutson this summer. Yeah, I think that wouldn't be a bad route for them, even though, again, Celebrini probably is too good to be playing college hockey next season.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's little like habits and things you can work on along the way, but at the same time, want to make sure in like key developmental years that players are stimulated in terms of like facing legitimate challenges and obstacles and then having to problem solve their way around it, as opposed to like, all right, I've already scored this many goals, I'm just going to keep doing that, and this is what I do. Like, I want him in a situation where he fails a little bit so that he has to build other tools to get by later on in his career. And I'm not sure if that would happen at the NCAA. Certainly would not happen in Major Junior. So it would be fascinating to see what happens there. Here's one more NCAA. Go for it.
Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to say about that, to your point that you just made, is the what, like, if you ask his coach, Jay Pandolfo at BU, like, what makes him such a special player? And he's like, well, obviously the talent, right? Like, the way this kid shoots the puck is outrageous. And the way he sees the ice is like plus plus or whatever you want to say. But what he really does like better than anybody, again, this is according to his coach, is the way he like prepares for games and the level he practices at and the ambition to get better every game or every week or whatever you want to say is like off the charts with him. Him and Lane Hutson kind of both have that quality. Again, according to the coach, like, these guys attack practicing as opposed to just like, yeah, we practice, you know? And again, that's something that you can do a lot more of in college hockey because you only really play on the weekends for the most part. And that's a benefit to, you know, like riding a bus around the WHL. And especially in Hockey East, where all the teams are within like 3 hours of BU, thereabouts, 3.5. It's a bus league where you're in your own bed 6 nights out of the week on average. Like, that's a huge benefit to him staying in college hockey as well. I don't know that he will necessarily, but if he does, like, I wouldn't see that as any kind of a problem for him.
No, it sounds like you're personally invested in keeping him at BU. So you can keep.
I mean, I'd like to see him play live more. Yeah, that's true. I've seen him probably 10, 11 times this year. It's great. It's
the best. That rocks. I like that.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. While we're on the NCAA topic, here's a question for you then. Which player do you think stands a chance to make the most immediate impact after this NCAA season ends with an NHL team, if any? Do you think there's someone you could foresee with situation, need for that team, and legitimate talent level they've already displayed at the NCAA, where you feel like in the final couple games of the regular season or right in jumping into the deep end in the playoffs, they could come in and make some sort of an impact for whoever their team that drafted them was?
I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the guys that I think you would say that about in general are guys who are drafted by teams that aren't likely to make the playoffs. You know, again, Cutter Gauthier, there's a guy that's an NHL player right now. He's an NHL player. Again, talk about a goal a game in college or whatever, you know. But yeah, I'm just, again, Lane Hutson, Montreal pick. So he's not going to be making a huge difference. Massimo Rizzo, I mean, he's hurt right now, but like he's a Flyers pick. So, I mean, the Flyers could still make the playoffs, but I don't know what the timeline is on him returning. So yeah, it is, there's nobody that like super jumps out to me as being like, you know, like Chris Kreider was when he came out of college and was just like immediately impactful for the Rangers in the playoffs. Was that Chris Kreider?
It was. What about Rutger McGroarty for the Jets? I know they kind of, after adding Toffoli, they are in less of a need, I guess, of an impactful winger, but it feels like he's pretty physically mature and ready. And, you know, they're certainly right there atop the West. And I think they could use as much firepower as they can to keep up with teams like Dallas and Colorado. So I think that would be an interesting one if they could actually get something functional out of him down, like in the playoffs this season, as like an added little boost that we might not have been expecting.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's, again, like you said, it's kind of a depth issue thing for like, where does he slot into that lineup? I don't, like, he hasn't, I don't want to, like, take a shot at the guy or anything like that. He's having a great season, but he's not a guy where I look at him and I'm like, lock it in. There's a guy who's going to make a huge difference for an NHL team in a way that, again, like a Cutter Gauthier does, because again, it's just with Cutter, it's just like instant offense. And I don't feel the same way about McGroarty, although he's been like red hot since returning from injury. He missed a, I want to say from like November to January, he just wasn't in the lineup. And since he came back, like, Michigan's really taken off with him as kind of the driver of that. But again, does that, like, I don't know how much that helps the Jets to have him in the lineup. Like, he certainly would help. He's probably better than whoever you want to say their like worst winger is right now. He's better than that guy for sure. But, you know, he's not going to get power play minutes or anything like that for them. So.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I think the Toffoli addition certainly made that less of a pressing need.
Yep.
I would have said before, I'm like, all right, we need to get Vlad Nemestikov out of the top six. So if you could get some Rutger minutes there, I'd be intrigued. But you know, there's always injuries, and I think having depth and players who could step up and produce is certainly always useful if they're going to make a long playoff run. All right, let's do a couple more quick ones here. Beast says, who got the better 2C at the deadline? The Avs with Mittelstadt or Vegas with Hurdle? Would the fits be better if swapped? Now, obviously, we have not seen Tomas Hurdle actually play yet for Vegas because he's hurt, and I think that's going to factor into my answer here. But I'm curious for your take on this. You could take it from the Mittelstadt perspective or from Vegas and Hurdle, because I think that's obviously one that's, you know, rich with nuance.
I mean, on paper, I think you would say Hurdle for now is definitely the better player, like, just on paper. Obviously, it's tough because he just played so much on an absolutely abysmal team that, you know, the stats aren't there in the way they kind of are with Mittelstadt. But just like as a baseline blind draw, who would you rather have, Mittelstadt or Hurdle? I think who's not saying Hurdle? You know what I mean? And I say this fully acknowledging I'm a true Hurdle, like early days Hurdle head, you know? So that is obviously also swaying my opinion. But yeah, obviously I like I said, I just generally speaking rather have Tomas Hurdle than Casey Mittelstadt. And I don't think that's like a controversial opinion at all.
No, that's fair. I will say from Vegas's perspective, why it's interesting is not only could they like legitimately use Mittelstadt playing right now if you were to flip this situation.
For
because
sure,
of their
yeah.
situation, I think also just like the pace he's able to play with at this point of his career would be intriguing for Vegas, because they look very slow to me when I watch them, and I don't think Hurdle's necessarily going to help that very much. Now, you can't necessarily look at this in a vacuum, right? Because Hurdle is 5 years older, and his contract, and I talked about this at the time of the trade deadline, where even with the retention, he's, you know, Vegas is do $6.75 million on him for his age 31 through 36 seasons for a player who has a scary injury history and is quite literally hurt right now. Vegas is uniquely equipped to take on that risk because they always do that, and they're just going to make it work and find a way to either get out of it or move stuff around to accommodate it in those years. So they could just do that. I think Colorado would have been much more reticent to do so because they already have a big unknown in Gabriel Landeskog moving forward. And I don't think they would necessarily love a situation where now you add another big piece like that, where you have no idea what you're going to get from them or whether a year or two from now it's just going to be LTIR money for you to worry about. And so I think Colorado is perfectly happy with Mittelstadt here because of that stuff, like with his RFA years and everything. And I watching him play on that team, not only has he fit in perfectly as we would have expected with both him and Chad Walker, but if anything, he looks much faster than I remember him looking in Buffalo. And that's probably just like the Colorado just speeds everything up when you drop that in there. But just watching him play, it's like, man, he was obviously very good and quite a prolific playmaker the past couple of years in Buffalo, but just watching the speed he's operating at right now and how he's just seamlessly fit in, I've been sort of impressed and taken aback a little bit by just watching that play in real time.
Yeah, no, like you said, I just read the question more as,
of course, yeah, which player is better?
Who's the better one? And I, but Yeah, with fits and everything. The thing with that you mentioned with Mittelstadt just like making Vegas play faster. The thing that I always wonder about is like, yeah, but like, could they keep up with him? You know what I mean? Like,
Right.
I don't know that like adding Hurdle is certainly not going to make Vegas faster, right? But like that, it might be more suitable to them to play faster, whereas adding Hurdle to Colorado like might slow Colorado down, and that's not obviously what they want. So yeah, I think both teams kind of got their guy in a lot of ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they both make sense for where they went. Okay, last one here from Tan Man. What went wrong with the Sabres this year?
I mean, I think everybody kind of the number one thing is that everybody was just kind of like, well, I mean, the goaltending's the big question. They missed the playoffs last year because of the goaltending. And I think a lot of the optimism was, well, sure, they overperformed offensively last season. They shot whatever, 12%. But if Devon Levi can come in and be a difference maker for them in the NHL, he can make up that difference. And then he didn't do that, right? Which is it's a tough ask for what is he, 2021? It's a tough ask to ask a rookie goaltender that young, first full pro season. Why don't you just step in behind the Buffalo Sabres and save our asses all year? How's that sound? That
Right.
that's just too hard.
But then they got an outrageously good season from Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen, which I don't think anyone saw
Yeah.
coming. And I think part of that ties into, they entered the season with, I think, like certainly a concern with goaltending and a desire to change their approach a little bit and to make it more friendly for them. And so I think in a way they really strayed too far from what made them so special and unique last year, even if it makes sense if you want to take that leap from being fun to good. It went too far, and they've been trying to sort of reverse course as the season's gone along. But it took away like that special element of what I loved about them. Right now, I think part of this is we have to acknowledge, like, I think Tage Thompson's injury to his wrist or hand or whatever he had in November really nuked their power play, because you look
Of
and
course.
he just like stopped taking slap shots, which made him so lethal last year. And that power play went from ninth in goals per hour to 26th. And that's like a 30 goal difference right there. And so maybe it was unrealistic to expect them to continue being that good because of the shooting percentage. And that would have regressed anyways. But I can't help but feel like if they were getting this season from Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen and the power play was not that good, but just more middling, that's the kind of the difference between being on the outside right now and taking advantage of this wide open Eastern Conference wildcard picture. And so that's a bit frustrating, but also, I guess, hopeful, because at the risk of falling into the trap all over again heading into next season, I feel like just getting Tage healthy and a couple tinkerings here and there is the difference between not necessarily becoming a Stanley Cup contender, but like legitimately finally getting back into the playoffs, which has been eluding them for this long.
Yeah, and the other thing I guess to say here is that they did do a little bit of the why don't we go out and get some veterans to help us be more respectable, spend money on your Connor Cliftons or whatever. And it's like, I mean, okay, man, sure. But I want to say this too. When Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen is not in the lineup for them, way below 900 goaltending, right? And he's only played, it says here, he's only played 44 games. So I think, you can point to that and go, well, there's your problem. When you get like horrible goaltending for 30 games or whatever it is this year, that's going to hurt you. I don't think we have to look at it too much deeper than that. Plus, like I said, the overperformance last year kind of, that's what made them fun last year, right? Was that like pucks were just jumping into the net for them. And if you want to say the Tage Thompson injury hampered that, of course it did, right? But I don't know. I just looked at them last year and said, like, well, they're not this good. And if we're counting on any goalie to like really step up for them and make them competitive. And again, we mentioned this earlier too. That division's just a beast. Like you, what are these guys supposed to do when, you know, the third best team in that division is the Toronto Maple Leafs? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what they do. I do think they have a bit of an issue with like diversity of skills and kind of problem solving. Like when they play teams that are defending against them a certain way, it feels like they don't really have very many answers. And I'm not sure how much of that is coaching or how much of that is players, right? Because we all love the job Granato did last year, for example, and like his connection with the players and cultivating those relationships and all of that from a development perspective. But I think we'd also agree that there's like two different types of coaches or skill sets behind the bench for like that side of things. And then tactically beating good teams, especially once you get into the playoffs and taking that next step in that sense. And that still remains to be seen whether he's the man for that job and what they do with that. So it'll be interesting to watch. Yep. I'll be back in on them again next season, assuming full health and assuming they do some good stuff in the off season. So TBD. Okay. Or I'll plug some stuff. We're heading out here. What do you want the listeners to check out or do you have anything in particular that you want to share?
Yeah. Over at EP Ringside, as we kind of alluded to, like college hockey season is wrapping up. This weekend is when conference championships will be decided, and we'll know the NCAA tournament field by Saturday night and all that kind of stuff. So that's I'm doing kind of wall-to-wall coverage of college hockey for the next few weeks here. I'm going to the Frozen Four in St. Paul in mid-April. Should be really fun. So yeah, if you want to know more about college hockey, I am your man for the next month or 3 weeks or so.
I love that. Yeah, if you enjoyed that 15-minute talk on RL's NCAA corner, then why not buy the full plays and check out his work and follow along. This was a blast, man. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for doing this. Thank you to the listeners for sending in the questions. As always, if you want to get involved in future editions of the Mailbag, pop into the PDOcast Discord. Invite link is in the show notes, and we'll be back with one more episode here to close out the week. Thank you for listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.